This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. MPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out mpr.nz for more information.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today I have with me
Michael Carter.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Okay, now Mike, you came to New Zealand in 1971 with your wife and a two-month-old daughter. A new start. Was it that you were building a new foundation for your life here? Was it?
I think so, yes, because inevitably we would be anyway. We were only, yep. We hadn't been married very long, and the first year of our married life was unusual because Norma was doing her house surgeon's job at the hospital, so I saw Norma for about an hour a week.
Ah, yes.
It was not the normal sort of first year of marriage. So really, we were at the point where we were going to have to start building a new life anyway.
So she was a qualified surgeon, was she?
House surgeon is just a student doctor. Well, your first couple of years as a...
Oh, so she'd done her basic training and the first couple of years.
Now she had a couple of years of what's
called... Was she able to take that qualification over here and work it?
Yes, she was.
And she did that?
Yes.
So she had a full career working in hospitals?
Well, she didn't work as a hospital. She worked in what was then the rehab unit at the hospital for a while, and then she became a general practitioner.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Worked that way until she retired. Oh.
And did she need to understand a lot about Maori culture and so on to do that?
I don't think so. I think I don't remember it ever being raised between us. And I suspect, from my recollection, most of her patients were of non-Maori background anyway.
Yeah, in the city.
I never recall it being a great issue.
Yeah. Okay. So. You were building up a new life here. What stood out in that?
Well, as I say, the first thing that struck me most forcibly was that students didn't work so hard.
Yes.
Certainly the difference when the children started going to school, you did notice, or we noticed anyway, that the school was very much a mixed race, because she was at Highbury School and there was a fairly big Maori population that lived in around Highbury. Yeah. So a lot of the students were brown rather than white. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, we noticed these things. And I remember when my uncle and aunt came out here for a visit, my aunt was Afrikaans background, and she was quite conservative, I think. And she looked at the school photograph, and she looked at it and she said, there's a lot of brown people in the photograph. So we didn't notice that. In fact, my daughter had I'm talking now about a 6 or 7 year old. She had a Maori boyfriend for a while, but nothing came of it. But basically, the lifestyle was not that different from what we remembered.
Yeah. Did you find, from your background, I know you felt open and you weren't happy with apartheid, but was it something that you had to come to terms with at all?
In South Africa?
No, here. Just finding your daughter going to a school that was very mixed like that.
I never had a problem with that. Yeah. I never had a problem.
You were consciously aware of it?
We were, on the whole, that was what we wanted. That was why we had moved.
Yeah. Yeah.
We didn't want our children to grow up in an apartheid society. So far as we're concerned, that was good. Hmm. But there was the difference, of course, that Maori obviously were and are still a minority in the population.
Yes.
Whereas in South Africa, I think the ratio was about 5 to 1 in favour of the blacks.
Yes.
So they were obviously a majority.
Yeah.
But you didn't see them, you know, they were removed from
the... So did you find that there was sort of cultural adjustments you had to make? Now there's a lot of emphasis on Maori culture and identity. Was there much in those days? Mid-70s.
No, not really. I mean, we knew there was a Maori culture, but the culture that we worked in and lived in was essentially European, English.
Yes.
So we didn't have to make any adjustments in that regard. Yeah. And there were very, very few Maori students at Massey at that stage.
Yeah, and then there was Maori studies, which moved on to... and they were somewhat separate anyway.
Well, it was a separate department.
And then they moved up the hill to a separate campus, essentially.
Yes, well, that was a different enterprise, though. That was the Pacific... You're talking about the Pacific...
No, not IPC. The Maori studies, or they had a new building up the further up the hill.
Possibly, I don't know. Yeah. I don't remember now.
Moved out to the social science tower quite a while ago. So when issues came up with the land marches and so on, what was your...
There were... I don't know about the land marches. I wasn't involved in those, but I've only been on two protest marches in my life.
Yeah.
And one was in Johannesburg when, as I think I mentioned, the government passed a rule requiring that Wits University should only admit white students.
Yeah.
And the whole university, I mean from the Chancellor on down, went on a protest march to the centre of Johannesburg. At that stage, I was a first-year student, so I was right at the back of the line, and we got water bombs thrown at it and so forth. But the only other protest I've been on was at the time of the Springbok tour here, the apartheid...
Yeah, 81.
In 81, and that was a march through the streets in Palmerston North. I remember vividly, I had my bicycle and I joined the march and pushing my bicycle, and I was stopped by one of the organisers who said the police would like me to leave my bicycle behind. I presume they thought if there was going to be a riot...
Well, it could be used as a weapon.
Or whatever, so I left my bicycle behind. But I only two protest marches I've been in, but the actual Maori protests, of course, I wasn't directly involved.
Yeah,
broadly in sympathy with what they were doing, but
I found there were some interesting aspects with the Raglan and Bastion Point and the legal rulings. It just didn't seem to fit my understanding of the law in Britain. I did feel, is this and it's probably the law wasn't the understanding that you have a principle in law, and if you want to change the principle you have to say, well, would you like that other interpretation applied in all the other cases that might work? And it should be consistent over a lot. And I felt there wasn't that same view in New Zealand, which clouded the matter somewhat.
Well, British common law has always been a bit of an oddity, isn't it? Compared to, say, the law in continental Europe. Very different sort of thing. The issue of Maori politics was interesting for us because obviously the Maori felt in many ways dispossessed and disadvantaged, whereas from our point of view, of course, compared to the blacks in Africa, they were vastly better off. They had people representing them in Parliament and so on. But we could see that there were still grievances and there were problems. Yeah. The history of New Zealand is very interesting when you compare it with the history of South Africa. I think the difference, in many ways, part of the difference was that in New Zealand the Maoris were in possession of the land when the white man came.
Yeah.
Whereas, as I mentioned, in Southern Africa, it wasn't quite so. The Dutch settlers, the original Dutch settlers, had the Cape virtually to themselves, and the blacks were moving down. So it was a somewhat different situation.
Do they want these people? Like, do you want these immigrants into your country?
But there wasn't. I mean, we didn't have a lot to do with Maori culture because even today, I suspect the. Well, it's different now, I suspect, but at the time we came here, there was very little influence of Maori culture on the universities. The universities were very much a European tradition, and we had very few Maori students. Hardly any prep, but I mean, maths maybe not to their taste. I remember we had, as an extramural class one year, we had three Maori students, two boys and their mother.
Yeah.
Well, I'd say two boys, they were teenage 20s or something. And the two boys failed and the mother passed, because basically what happened was the mother was egging the two boys on, you must work, you must study.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have any bar of it, but she, of course, diligently went on working, so she passed.
Yeah. I suppose that there's a difficulty because, in fact, things have become a lot more polarised, and once it becomes politicised to the extent it has now, these things become more extreme, the divisions become more extreme, mm-hmm. because I heard things like when there were sort of funding for married students, and people would say, well, so-and-so, who's blonde, blue-eyed, and so on, but could get that sort of support because of some Maori connections. Yeah. So you might think, well, there are no Maori here, but there's now do you identify as Maori or European or mixed and so on? And there's far more pressure of, you. In fact, society being viewed as a divide, Maori and the other, whereas there was probably a lot more mixing at their start. I remember people who friends who grew up in Levin, who said going to school, yes, there'd be the Maori kids there, we'd all just play together and that was it. But now they're far more conscious of the distinction or the chosen identity even, perhaps, maybe it's another example of you try to solve a problem, and by doing it you're emphasising differences, which actually exacerbates the problem.
Well,
it's
an interesting
point,
but the resurgence of Maori culture with the, what they call it, kura kapapa Maori and so on, the Maori, Maori nests and so on. Yeah. And these kids are being brought up in Maori schools and learning Maori as, I wouldn't say, well, I don't know whether it's their first language or not, but it's certainly the language they're learning at school. It's a good thing in a way, but you just can't have a feeling it would be better if everyone was, I suppose, coming from Southern Africa, I always felt, you know, that why separate? Why not just let everybody come together and be people together?
There's the issue, assimilation and integration. Assimilation, you make everyone the same. And integration, you're accepting difference and coexistence. And I can see difference is really good. It's nice to have the variety. Like we've mentioned all the different food things that you can access and the cultural mix in Palmerston North. That enriches the culture, but at the same time, it lessens the overall cohesion of the society. So if there's a major problem, how well will it work together? So there's a difficult, probably a balance, or maybe the speed of adjustment could be a problem. I don't know. If you look at British history or English history, is a whole series of mixtures and a new wave of inflow of a different culture that then over time fitted in until you really don't identify the differences anymore. But it's all enriching. So given time, it's beneficial, but too much done too soon or too acute or big differences at a time when you need a cohesive society, it can be a problem.
It is hard to know. I mean, I noticed it's not about England, but I noticed the difference between London and the rest of England this regard.
Oh, yeah. I, coming from the north of England, there's the north and the south, which is massively different.
Yeah.
Even a divide across the Pennines after the Wars of the Roses that still hasn't been forgotten.
But it was very interesting in South Africa, I thought, that When the apartheid system eventually collapsed, you have to say Nelson Mandela was an amazing man and he did an enormous amount, but it's often forgotten that de Klerk,
yes, he did a lot,
also had to do a great deal, although he doesn't get the publicity that Mandela did. And I mean, Mandela, as I say, was an amazing man, but the
with de Klerk, was it him saying, we've gone down the wrong track, how do we change then? Or,
well, I guess he always wanted a unified South Africa. And to get that, he was willing to sacrifice his life, basically, and the best part of it he spent in Robben Island prison. But
Mandela, you mean?
Mandela, and de Klerk, I think, he had the wit to realise that the Afrikaner couldn't hold out, he couldn't retain the separation, and that the best thing to do was to work with the black man rather than against him. But he had to take his people with him, and I remember at the time, there was the far right wing of the Afrikaners were saying, well, we'd rather just go and live by ourselves in the middle of the desert if necessary, but we want to keep separate.
Yeah.
The Purified National Party, how you could purify party, I don't know, there was always, but eventually I think you're right, a lot of people thought that South Africa would become a bloodbath, and the fact that it didn't, I think enormous credit goes to those two men.
Absolutely.
And to the forgiving spirit of the black man, it has to be said, because they had an awful lot to forgive.
Now, to get back to your life in New Zealand, and you had two children that have grown up, they knew obviously your South African roots. Is that something they're conscious of, or do they see any identification with South Africa at all?
I don't know about that. They've certainly both been to Africa, to Southern Africa, and they were acquainted with family members from Southern Africa. But
now that would colour their, obviously, that when they're going there, it's the family connections that would stand out. But what was their impression of the country?
Well, it has. They were both quite young when they first went back. Six or 7 years old, and so at that age you don't notice, except what's in your immediate vicinity. When they went back as young adults, South Africa had already changed enormously. So they never really experienced South Africa as it was in the apartheid days.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to say they've both grown up well. It's what makes me happy is that they're not really conscious of racial differences, and they're quite happy to treat everyone as a person, which is what we were hoping. And one of them moved back in England now. She's been in England for the last 20 odd years.
Yeah.
So she's gone full circle.
And your impression going back to South Africa, obviously there were big changes from the time when you left.
Oh, we noticed. Well, the first time we went back, not much had changed, in fact.
And that was about when?
It was about 1978, I think.
Okay.
But then the next visit back, I noticed that apartheid was ending its last phases, and it was really becoming very oppressive. And we noticed that.
This was about when?
Well, that would have been about 5 years later.
Okay, so you knew it was under pressure, South Africans knew it was under pressure, and they were being very defensive, were they?
There had been riots, and there was...
Okay.
I remember catching the train from Johannesburg to Pretoria, and at every station there were troops, armed troops, lining the platform to be sure that there were no trouble, you know? But even when I was still living in South Africa, we had the Sharpeville massacre, which you may remember. A group of Africans were gunned down at a police station. There were a lot of casualties, and I think I was a first year student at that time, helping out with tutoring, and I remember our lecturer, who one of the people who'd later gone to jail, she said to the we had a tutorial, and she said to the few students who were there, well, we would rather not be tutoring you, we because the students were having a boycott. But they said, well, we will, because we're paid, you know. And she asked me if I would agree with her on that, and I said, yeah, sure. So we ran the tutorial for a few students, but the temperature was slowly heating up in South Africa. So I was really very happily surprised when things didn't... I mean, there was bloodshed, but the fact that it didn't descend into chaos, I think, is enormous credit on the two leaders involved. You've got to... Well, the black people were willing to forgive and forget, and the white people were willing to adjust. Everyone has to bear some credit for it,
So when was the last time, or the most recent time, you've been back there?
Many times. I think it was. I think that might. Maybe it was the second trip that I can't really remember.
Yeah.
It would have been in the 80s anyway.
Okay. So have you? So you weren't have seen the post-apartheid.
Not really. When we were last, the apartheid was beginning to be relaxed.
Yeah. Okay.
But we haven't really seen the South Africa as has become.
You still have family there?
No close family, but I've still got relatives scattered about the place. Yeah.
Okay. You in contact with anyone?
No.
Okay. I did hear. I was for a while living next door to some people from South Africa, and the stories we had there saying about aging parents back there who have a string with tin cans on in the backyard, so that if there's any intruders, it makes a noise, and they're sort of thinking, you know, are they really safe there? It sounded quite shaky. But it's since then you hear of the car hijackings, and you know, if you stop a car at the lights, lock the doors.
The second time I visited, I was. Did some part-time lecturing at the university, and one of the African staff, I think, was murdered as he came to work on the university campus. That's the sort of thing that happened.
So the African staff was murdered.
I think it was an African. Yeah.
By
who knows?
a robber or something.
Well, people would be robbed for the coat on their backs if it was a nice coat, because life was cheap.
So, in terms of for you, bringing up a family in New Zealand, you were involved with schools, sports groups, orchestras.
I was involved. I was on the school committee and that sort of thing, and I collected stuff for the annual school fete. Oh, the usual sort of thing.
So PTA thing or Board of Trustees?
Any of those things.
You got PTA. Okay, so and you're on the PTA. What sort of time was this?
When my children were...
In the 80s, I suppose, was it?
Where are we? It would be through the 80s, yeah.
Yeah. So, and how was that? What were you doing on that? Did you feel it was you were mainly fundraising for the school?
That and just looking after things. And I remember one summer, we just planted some grass at the kindy, and I was on the kindy committee, and my job over the summer was to water the new grass. That sort of thing.
So the Parent Teachers Association, there a lot of parent involvement, and this is mainly volunteering in supporting the school?
Bottle drives and that sort of thing.
Fundraisers.
Usual.
Which school was it?
The children started off at Highbury School, and then they went to Monreal Intermediate, and then one daughter went to Awatapu and the other to Girls High.
Okay, that was their choice, was it, which school they went to?
I think it was, basically, yes.
Yeah. And you were happy with the choice of school?
They both worked out well.
If you wanted the diversity of background for the kids, then I suppose Highbury was better than...
Well, we were pleased that they went to Highbury School. You say, there was a more diverse background, and we wanted them to mix with all sorts of different people. You know, we didn't want them to grow up in an exclusive society. I mean, I remember when the first time we went back to South Africa, it was the first time, and my elder daughter went to the local school, which was much more regimented than the school here. But there were two birthday parties. Two girls in her class had birthday parties. Mm. And one of them was a typical privileged white girl, and the other was from what I suppose you'd call one of the poorer suburbs, and which was the one that Susan chose to go to. And I took Susan along, and it turned out that when I went to pick her up, she was the only person who'd gone to that party. Everyone else had gone to the other party.
At the same time?
And I was kind of proud of Susan.
Yes, absolutely. So the other one wasn't invited to, or they just...
They were invited to both, but you know...
The one who had the other party hadn't been invited to, or...
Well, I guess... They couldn't have had them.
Okay.
That was interesting.
Yeah. It's because I think a lot of the Massey staff their children would have gone, there were certain schools that a lot of Massey staff went to, and they, you know, Highbury, I suppose you're the other side of town to the university, so...
Yes, a lot of university people lived in Hokafitu
and
Riverdale. So, we were a bit out on a limb, but on the whole, I was pleased about that. I thought that was good.
You get the diversity through that.
Yeah.
which is good. And that your two daughters have gone on to do what after that?
Well, one of them trained as an architect and then had four children. Mm-hmm. And now she's back working again and finds it incredibly hard work.
Yes, yeah, career and family is difficult.
Well, her family and now two of them are at university and the other have nearly finished school. But the second daughter, the elder of the two, she went to England.
Yes.
And they lived in an English village. And she trained as a librarian.
Yes.
But she's very, very happy just growing stuff in the garden and keeping the house and listening. Her latest hobby is to listen to the bats. She had a lovely time and she has no desire to get back in paid work, and her husband luckily earns enough to support them. And she does a lot at home.
I can picture that. Probably a very active village life, wouldn't community?
Oh, there is, yes.
Is that in the southeast or...?
Near Bath, she's about.
Oh, okay. A nice part of the world.
Her village is technically in Wiltshire, I think.
Yes, yeah.
It's on the border between Wiltshire and Somerset.
Yes, yeah.
I've spent quite a few visits there.
Yeah, I've spent. So it's a nice part of the world. Mm. Yeah. Mm. So, and do you ever get over to England then?
Or? Well, I have been. Up until the COVID struck, I was visiting England every other year. I was spending holidays with them. Since COVID, I haven't been over, and I think now I'm probably past it. I don't know if I could cope with this 24-hour
flight. It's a long way, I feel this. So COVID changed attitudes to that, didn't it?
Well, I'm also a bit older.
Yes,
I've certainly spent a lot of time with them in England, and I've watched her children grow up, so that's good.
Yeah. And you felt as at home in England?
Oh, yeah, I always have. I love England. I don't know if I'd want to live there. Well, I think living in rural England has a lot going for it, but I think the cold winters might do me.
They're not as cold as they used to be. But having grown up, I just find it too crowded now. I'm used to more open spaces that we have here.
But it's amazing where they live. Yeah. You can still go for a walk in the woods and not see another living soul, you know.
Very nice. Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.